I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. With all that's going on in the country and around the world, you might have missed the news that Pennsylvania finally has a budget for this fiscal year after a four-month impasse. Governor Wolf signed the $32 billion spending plan a few weeks ago, and there was agreement on how to cover the $2 billion deficit by borrowing money, using tobacco settlement funds, and expanding gambling. We asked Katie Meyer to join us. She covers Harrisburg, the legislature for WITF and WHYY, to fill us in on the details. And Katie Meyer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what brought the sides together on this budget plan?
Well, it's funny. It feels like it's been over for a while now. We've already moved on to other issues. But yeah, I mean, this was still pretty recent, and it was a long-standing impasse. So what finally brought them together was really, first of all, they were under a lot of pressure because the budget was so late. The gambling expansion, that was really the last thing they had to agree on. And they did agree because there were really few other options for revenue. The most contentious part of the gambling agreement was video gaming terminals, remote video gaming terminals, or VGTs, as people call them. And they came to an agreement on that basically by saying, all right, they're only going to be allowed in truck stops in counties that already have casinos. And there's going to be an opt-out provision. So lots of counties are already opting out of that.
Let me pick up on a couple of things just in case people were not paying enough attention.
Sure.
To this expansion of gambling. First of all, how much money do they hope to generate from expanded gambling?
It's not that much, honestly, in the context of the entire $32 billion budget. It's about $100 million, give or take, maybe a little bit more or less, depending on, you know, how lucrative it is. But it is a relatively small portion of the budget. And so this expansion includes, as I said, video gaming terminals in truck stops and also 10 new miniature casinos. And those can be put in a variety of places, but municipalities can opt out of hosting one of those, and we're seeing hundreds doing that already.
And what is their explanation for that?
Well, it really depends. Some municipalities say we don't want a casino. Some feel like their communities are too small to have one. A lot of the people or the municipalities that have opted out are like townships, smaller towns that just probably wouldn't host one anyway. But so far we've seen about 200 of them. There are certain patterns. We've seen more opt-outs in Lancaster County where there has been some anti-gambling sentiment. Chester County has sort of a cluster of opt-outs as well, but it has been across the state.
My understanding is that Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney also opposes the expansion in Philadelphia. And of course, there already are large standing casinos in the city.
Yes, that's true.
So if I'm not driving a truck or I'm not at a truck stop, where am I going to see a video gaming terminal, in a bar or restaurant or an airport or someplace like that?
Well, you're going to see different, sort of gambling terminals in airports. There's like iPad-style games in airports that have been legalized now, so that was part of the expansion. But the VGTs, they're really going to be limited to truck stops and only truck stops in counties that already host casinos anyway. So it's pretty small. But that being said, one of the reasons that this got passed in the first place is people were saying, listen, it's already happening. A lot of, like, even convenience stores, bars and taverns had illegal VGTs in them already. So, people were saying, you know, we should just regulate this thing that's happening. So that seems to be the track they're going on there. So you might, come across one out in the wild somewhere, but they're not going to be super, super common.
And where are they getting the rest of the money to cover the deficit?
Oh, lots of places, but it's mostly borrowing. They're borrowing, lots of money against about $2 billion against the state's tobacco settlement fund. And that's, it's a fund that we've been getting since the mid-90s from tobacco companies, and it's, recurring revenue. So we're going to be borrowing against that for the next, decade or two, probably two decades. That's the bulk of it. The rest of it, it's from a mix of fund transfers. Some of those we don't know where they're coming from yet because the governor is going to have to decide. And he's indicated that he's not going to make those fund transfers unless he absolutely has to. If revenue keeps coming in above expectations, as it's been doing so far in the first couple of months of the fiscal year, he may not make those fund transfers, although it seems likely that he's going to have to at some point.
And so he has that, in a sense, in his back pocket in case it needs to be used?
Yes, essentially. And he didn't really want to make those fund transfers. That was something that Republicans had been pushing for in the legislature, sort of this idea of, you know, using money that we already have, just, you know, moving around funds. But, you know, I mean, we do, credit rating agencies say when you keep balancing the budget like this, it's not great for your long-term fiscal health because, you know, then the next year you have to find a new one-time source of revenue. So there's very little, I think the upshot of this budget, there was very little recurring revenue. And so we're going to be in a similar situation next year. And our independent fiscal office has already said, you know, next year's looking like we're going to have about $1 billion imbalance going into budget negotiations, which are starting in just a couple of months. So you get a sense of where we are.
Well, the Governor Wolf has always looked to a severance tax on Marcellus Shale as a source of revenue, but he doesn't seem to be able to get enough people in support of that. Is that basically a dead issue, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have, I mean, it did not come up in this budget, and, you know, that's kind of seems like the obvious time to bring it up, but they couldn't get it. So, yeah, we're still talking about the severance tax. The governor still says, you know, he wants it. Debate has gone on the floor as recently as last week, and it may resume this week on the tax. But at this point, we have this thing that, you know, doesn't really resemble the severance tax that the governor initially wanted. For one thing, you know, he had very high revenue projections for his, you know, initial vision for this severance tax. But as it stands, it would only make somewhere around $100 million, give or take, you know, gas prices.
Right.
So that's not very much money, again, in the grand scheme of this budget. And it's also got tons and tons of amendments filed to it at this point. It's got something like, you know, almost 400 amendments.
What?
And so, yeah, I know, it's a lot. And so, you know, what that would do is a lot of them would create permitting changes that environmental groups really don't like, to make it easier for instance, natural gas companies to get permits that they need to drill more. So, you know, it's become something that a lot of Democrats actually oppose because they think it would do more harm than good. So is it a dead issue? No, I think it's going to keep coming up. But it doesn't look super good for severance tax fans at this moment.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things. One, an abortion bill that is, or an anti-abortion bill that's making its way through the legislature. What do we know about that?
So that bill would do a couple of things. It would narrow the window for late-term abortions. Under current law, you can get an abortion up until 24 weeks gestation. This would, you know, reel that back to 20 weeks. You know, proponents of this measure say, well, you know, a fetus can survive outside the womb for like earlier and earlier thanks to medical advances. Opponents say this would really cut down on women's options if they have, for instance, a medical scare and like late in their pregnancy, or if they find out at you know, their 20 or 21 week scan that there's something just devastatingly wrong with, you know, the baby that they're carrying. So you know, there, lots and lots of medical professionals have weighed in on this. Sort of Christian doctors associations, religiously affiliated associations, some have backed it. Most unaffiliated doctors, unreligiously affiliated doctors, oppose it. And so it's been a very controversial issue here. It would also, I should say, ban a procedure known as dilation and evacuation. In the bill, it's referred to as dismemberment abortion, which you can sort of, you know, that's more vivid. But that's not really a medically recognized term. So there's been some, you know, lack of clarity about what exactly that ban would do. But it would, for any doctor who performed this procedure, they could be liable for, you know, like felony charges. So it would be, it would make it a criminal thing.
If it passes, is there, Governor Wolf has pretty much been on record saying that he would oppose this. He would not sign this bill.
Yes, the governor's been very clear that he would veto this bill. You know, we have been asking supporters of it if they think they have enough power to override a veto. that's a very hard thing to do. And I feel like even pro-life Democrats, you'd have a hard time getting them on board to override the governor on this, on such a controversial issue. But yeah, we'll see. But no, Governor Tom Wolf has been very clear that he would strike down this bill.
There's another issue that's making its way through the legislature having to do with pension forfeiture. This seemed to involve a former Democratic Senator, Robert, is it Mueller?
Mello.
Couldn't read my own handwriting there. Katie, tell us about Robert Mello and where this stands.
Sure. So we go from abortion, very controversial, to this, not so controversial anymore. Under current law, lawmakers and any other state employee has to, they have to forfeit their pension if they're convicted of a certain list of state crimes, or if there's a felony crime that closely enough resembles a state crime on that list, they'll also have to forfeit their pension. Now, this gets kind of dicey because it becomes sort of unclear when somebody has to forfeit their pension if they're convicted of a felony, which is what happened in the Mello case. He lost his pension, appealed, and then it was ruled that he could actually keep it because his felony was just different enough from the state law on the books that would have, you know, caused that pension forfeiture. So now what this bill would do is it would create, it would expand the law to include any felony related to a person's job. So this would also kind of circumvent the, or get rid of the circumvention, I guess, the loophole that there was there before where somebody would plead to a specific crime that just, like, was not on the list, so they'd be able to keep their pension even if they did go to prison. So it would strengthen the existing law.
Sure.
And this has passed the House twice. The Senate, it stalled in the Senate last session, but now Governor Wolf has thrown his support behind it. So it seems likely that the Senate will pass it this time around.
Final question to you, that having to do with Daryl Metcalf, a touch screen, I should say a touch scene across social media. Last week he went after Matthew Bradford, who touched his arm and essentially accused him of, I don't know, coming on to him. I'm not sure how to...
Along
those lines, saying I'm a heterosexual, I have a wife, I love my wife, I don't like men as you might, but stop touching me all the time. Where do things stand with these two gentlemen?
It's interesting. Bradford and Metcalf, obviously, they're very different politically. They have, you know, they're together in this committee. And they've had, you know, tension before. They tangle often. I think Bradford resents the way that Metcalf runs the committee. He's known as a pretty tough committee chair. He's threatened, for instance, to have, you know, Capitol Police, you know, throw Bradford out of meetings when they've had problems. Metcalf says that this touching problem has been an ongoing thing and that Bradford's trying to bait him. Bradford says he's doing no such thing. I think the upshot of this is that Matt Bradford now says he's probably not going to touch Daryl Metcalf on the arm. He's going to be conscious to not do that. That's where that stands.
We will leave it there. Katie Meyer, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She covers Harrisburg for WITF and WHYY. An email from Adam, I think it's very sad. They need to expand gambling to make up for revenue not collected by Marcellus Shale taxes. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The Rhodes Trust recently announced the names of 32 people chosen from more than 600 applicants across the country who are Rhodes Scholars. Hazeem Hardiman is one of those scholars, a Community College of Philadelphia and Temple University First, who will study next year at Oxford University in England. He grew up in North Philadelphia. His mother was determined that he get a good education. He graduated from Temple University, where he works as an adjunct, and he's interested in prison reform. He was a guest on Radio Times a couple of years ago when we did a show about people who are first in their family to go to college. He joined us once again on Radio Times. Hazeem Hardiman, a great pleasure to have you back with us on Radio Times, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me back.
I asked you this before going on the air. Have you come back down to earth?
Yeah, it's all been sort of surreal. And it's been a whirlwind, but I haven't been completely swept up by it.
You have not been?
No, I think my feet are still on the ground.
Oh. How does one learn that one is a Rhodes Scholar?
Yeah, so at the culmination of the sort of process, which first begins with a reception, and then you do an interview, and the committee that interviews you deliberates for a couple of hours, and they actually line you all up. It was 14 of us in my district.
They line you up,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, so they put us in a really small room, and there's 14 of us, and we're lined up horizontally, and they say your name in alphabetical order, and from there you know.
And from there you know.
Yes.
Wow. And when you're told something like that, how does that register?
How do you register
something like that?
I don't know if it does. You're sort of swept up in a whirlwind of emotions, and everything from there is a blur once you hear your name. There's so many things to ponder, so I think it's almost really difficult to sort of get your thoughts in order. It's really a blur.
There was a professor at Temple University who really encouraged you to apply for a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah.
Why and what was that like?
Yeah. So the person who really encouraged me to apply was the director of our honors program, Dr. Ruth Ost. And she had heard me speak on a number of occasions. The first time was at the culmination of a course, which was the Inside Out Prison Exchange right. program.
Which is a great program
yeah,
at Temple, working
absolutely.
With people in prison and Temple students.
Yeah, a completely transformative program. And I took a deaf and dying course at Greater for Prison, and I was chosen by my peers to offer some reflection on the course. And she was there to hear me offer those reflections, and from there she thought I had what it took to be a Rhodes Scholar.
Wow. So how does one apply? And I assume you have to write an essay and
yes,
besides
yes.
answering lots yeah. and lots of questions.
Yeah. So you can't apply to the scholarship directly. What happens is your university has to endorse you. Right. So when a university feels that they have somebody who's qualified to apply to the scholarship, they'll put them up as an endorsement. And from there, you apply in either the district that your school is located in or your home district. And for me, both would have been Pennsylvania. So
yeah.
my district was Pennsylvania and Rhode Island. And there's 16 districts across the country. And two students are selected from each district. And I applied for Pennsylvania, was named a finalist, and obviously awarded the scholarship.
Absolutely. So what did you write about in your essay?
I wrote about how transformative the prison experience was for me. And I really talked about how learning from the inside students, how that precipitated my rethinking of what justice should look like.
Right.
And that's really, for me, a move from a justice that is sort of imbued with an ethic of punishment to a justice that is imbued with an ethic of love. And that's a sort of conception that I arrived at by being in conversation and being in dialogue with the inside students.
And the inside students were prisoners at Greaterford.
Yeah, prisoners, right? all part of the hospice program, yep.
The idea of what? People who are hurt people. I've heard that.
Yeah, that. But even moving beyond just focusing on the hurt part, it's about how do we make people whole, right? And that's something that they're on intimate terms with, because they're confined to these certain conditions, but at the same time, they draw insights from those conditions. And it's this notion of wounded healers, right? So hurt people, but also hurt people can heal people.
Sure. Now, you grew up not far from Temple University. How close to the campus?
About four or five. Well, I always underestimated, like six or seven blocks, so 23rd and Diamond.
Right, so that was kind of your neighborhood
there. Yeah, it was my neighborhood, although at many times it felt like a different world, but at the same time it was our neighborhood.
You, as I read about you, and I remember from our interview a couple of years ago, there have been a number of people. I mean, you obviously deserve the lion's share of the credit and accolades for the hard work that you've done. But nonetheless, it seemed like your mother was just determined that you get a good education.
Yeah, and I think that was really an experience from her life experiences. Although she didn't really make it far in her education, she understood the value and importance of a quality education, especially early on. And that's why she made sure through any means necessary that my brother and I had a quality education.
What did she do? How did she make that happen?
Yeah. So she falsified our zip code for we can attend a school that simply had resources. Right? So although I grew up in North Philadelphia, born and raised, I attended school in the Roxborough section of the city at Shelby Elementary.
And she falsified the zip code so you could go there?
Yeah, she falsified the zip
code. I mean, on purpose and for that
yeah.
reason.
And I always say, for her, she understood the decision as life and death. So it's easy to understand it in a sort of abstract, sort mm-hmm. of ethical question. But for her, it has to be assessed within the circumstances mm-hmm. of her life and our own. And she understood that this could either put us on a number of trajectories if we were forced to go to our neighborhood schools. And not because the schools in and of themselves are bad, but oftentimes they're starved of resources, and it's right. impossible to learn under those conditions.
Was that a long transportation, public transportation ride to get from North Philly to Roxborough?
Yeah, it was. So I had to wake up every day about 5 o'clock in the morning and be bused out. The good part of the story is that since we were good students, when they find out that we actually didn't live in the neighborhood, they agreed to bus us out, and they told our mom it was because we were such good students.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Hazeem Hardiman, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, and graduated from Temple University last spring, summer. He works there now as an adjunct and was chosen just one of 32 people in this country to be a Rhodes Scholar. And I should underscore the fact that this is a first for Temple University, also a first for Community College of Philadelphia. If you want to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I'm reading too many things at the same time. You can also email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I have a tweet from Hip Hop and Higher Education. Hey, WHYY Radio Times, can you ask Hazeem what role did hip hop play during his collegiate experience? Go ahead.
Yeah, so my senior year, I wrote a article, which is a rhetorical criticism, which I presented at a number of conferences across the country. And I looked at Jay-Z's role as a public pedagogue in his song, Song Cry, which is interesting to reflect on
now.
Yeah, Song Cry. And the song, the premise of it is him sort of pining for somebody that he's done wrong. But at the same time, he refused to admit that he's done wrong because his sort of notion of masculinity. So for me, hip-hop is a sort of feckin' sight to look at what conditions have shaped, for me, black people in America, because this is an art form that arises from the conditions that they have been forced to confront. So for me, it's not only instructive in terms of how can it give us insights into their lives, but also how can it offer us alternative ways of being and knowledges to develop to change those conditions that people are forced to live under.
And that was your essay, in a sense, related to that.
Yeah. So I looked at how his notion of masculinity was sort of shaped in a crucible of economic immiseration, a lack of outlet to job opportunities and poor schooling, and a sort of breakdown of the family structure, largely attributed to things like mass incarceration. Yeah. And looked at what can we learn from his articulation of his notion of masculinity, and how can that articulation bring to bear insights on our current conversations that can subject them to transformation.
You see that in your neighborhood?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my goals as a scholar is to rely on or to sort of draw on the knowledges that emanate from my community, because I think we contain within our own wisdoms the sort of answers to our civic and social problems.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I was thinking about it because much has been made of the fact that you're from North Philadelphia, you're going from North Philadelphia to study in England, and how unusual that is, and in many ways that is. But at the same time, you're a product of North Philadelphia.
No, absolutely. I think the conditions that make it unusual are usually what's emphasized. But I couldn't have a stronger support system from my friends in North Philadelphia, my extended family in North Philadelphia, but also the institutions that are bedrocks of that community, like my recreation center, Hank Gathers, where I received just love in every way, where I got to grow as a person. So the community is very rich and sort of littered with a bunch of institutions that are sort of bedrocks.
Yeah. I was also reading, and there was a period, I guess, in high school, your mom actually had to go to Atlanta for a while, and I guess you were living with other members of the family, but it sounded like it was a rocky period for you and your family.
Yeah, it's difficult because me, as a sort of teenager at the time, it was easy for me to lose focus and lose sight of what was important. So that was a sort of downtime in my high school moment, but when she was able to come back and be back in our lives, and I had the proper sort of guidance,
that's
when everything got back on track.
And where were you in high school at the time?
I was in high school at Morrill Dobbins.
At Dobbins High School, right. And you just sort of felt like you lost your way, or you just didn't have someone to show you the way, in a way?
Yeah, my mom was always the person who kept me in line, so to speak. But also, she was the person to keep me focused in terms of making sure I understood what was important. Right. And when she was removed from the situation, it became easier to lose sight and to sort of go off and do my own thing and not really understand. In the midst of adolescence and just trying to figure out the world, it can be easy to lose sight of what's important.
Sure. But you got into community college. How did that happen?
Yeah. So fortunately, the Community College of Philadelphia accepts everybody. And I knew I wanted to go there because they had a mechanism in place through admissions that allow you to seamlessly transfer to a number of neighborhood schools. And I knew if I eventually wanted to get to Temple that CCP would provide me with a seamless.
Right?
Yeah,
to get to Temple.
That was a goal. Yeah. I knew that CCP would provide me with a seamless transition to Temple University.
How do they do that?
So dual admission. So you complete your bachelor's degree, I believe, with like a 2.3 GPA. And you're able to go to a number of institutions, which of Temple is one.
Well, and it seems like for you that those years at community college helped you kind of reorient yourself, get yourself together as a scholar, as a student.
Yeah, as a scholar, as a thinker, as a person. They allowed me to sort of get my feet on the ground and to establish some habits and abilities that I probably wouldn't have been afforded time to establish had I initially been thrown into a four-year university. So CCP was formative in every way for me.
In what way? I mean, habits. What kind of habits?
Yeah, so things like reaching out to your professors, right? Some of my best opportunities have come via relationships with my professors, and that's a habit that I developed at CCP, which was really a training ground for that, making sure that you go to office hours, making sure that your professors know your interests, so that when opportunities do come up, they have you in mind.
And also reading. You did a promotional video, in a way, reading and relationships, right?
Yeah. No, reading is so important. Reading saved my life. It changed my life. And I really started reading seriously while I was at CCP, just going to the library, picking up books and perusing the aisles and just reading everything I could get my hands on.
What books really stayed with you, were important to you at the time?
So the first book I read at CCP that really changed my life and set me on the path I am now was a book by Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. So it's an interesting text to be reading at that time.
It sure
and
is.
And at that age. But pedagogy is something that I'm still very much interested in. And the idea that education can be geared towards self and social transformation is something that has really stuck with me.
So that transition then from community college to Temple University, was that a relatively smooth one for you?
Yeah, it was relatively smooth. At that time, like you said, I had been oriented toward doing certain things. So when I got to Temple, I was sort of laser focused and I was able to hit the ground running.
So what did it feel to be, I mean, in a sense, your neighborhood college or university, there it was, but to be on campus?
Yeah, it felt like it validated my presumption that within Temple's own backyard, there are students who are able to come to these universities and do great things. And if we were just provided the opportunity, then that can sort of materialize and we can see that happen.
So you're going to be heading off to England for 2 years.
Yep.
Have you ever been out of the country?
I haven't been out of the country before.
You have a passport?
No, I'll get that soon. Yeah.
So what do you hope to be studying?
I hope to study MPhil, Masters of Philosophy and Political Theory.
For all the reasons we've been talking about.
Yeah, and I think for me, what I want to do in terms of my intellectual experience at Oxford is to become conversant with a wide range of sort of analytical and interpretive lenses. That way I can bring them to bear on whatever I decide to bring under examination.
You were telling me before going on the air that you like teaching and would like to be a professor? Is
yeah, absolutely.
Goal?
Yeah, so I was hired as an adjunct at Temple and I'm co-teaching a course, Misperceptions and Misinformation, and I couldn't be more incredibly excited because the university for me represents one of the few places where people are committed to thinking critically about the world around them. So I never want to leave.
That's great. These are some of the details. When you're a Rhodes Scholar, you get to pick a college.
Yes.
Where you live? Is that what it means?
Yeah, where college? You live. Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
And you chose a place called Hertford?
Hertford College, yeah.
Tell us about Hertford and why this place is important to you.
Yeah, so I chose Hertford after learning about the story of actually the first black Rhodes Scholar, a guy named Alain Leroy Locke, who was actually a product of Philadelphia public school systems. And it's interesting because he went to Central, and at the time that he graduated Central, they had an extension school focused on pedagogy, which my research is heavily focused on.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the sort of parallels.
Did you know about him before you?
I heard about him, but I didn't really know his story. Mm-hmm. But Alain Locke is largely considered the dean of the Harlem Renaissance. He was a huge proponent of the arts, and he was a philosopher himself. But he became the first black Rhodes Scholar in 1907. And at the time, I don't think they had an in-person interview component. So when he was selected, I don't know if they knew he was black or not. But he was selected in 1907. And as a result of the sort of socio-political climate, a lot of the colleges in Oxford refused to house him. And
at
the time,
because he was black?
Yeah, because he was black. And at the time, students from the American South who were selected as Rhodes Scholars refused to live with him and to be seen at events with him. So eventually this college, Hertford College, came along and they accepted him. And even though he had a sort of isolating and alienating experience at Oxford because he was a black person there, that legacy is one that's important for me. So I chose it based off that criteria.
And you'll hear in a couple of months whether they accept you.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You still have to sort of gain admissions to the college. Yep.
Right. How does your mother feel as from...
Yeah.
A mother sitting across from you here.
Right.
How does your mom feel?
Yeah, she couldn't be more proud of me. She's incredibly excited, just like everybody else in the rest of my family. And she felt like her decisions have borne fruit, yeah.
So what's the, I guess, message from your life? I mean, what do you think, what we know about you,
yeah,
how can we expand that to other people?
Right. I think the message from my life is that I'm not necessarily any more exceptional than anybody from my neighborhood. I'm the product of opportunity in many ways. And, of course, I have skills and abilities, but I was put into positions where I was able to cultivate and develop those skills and abilities. Mm-hmm. And I think if those opportunities are extended to more people that come from where I come from, then the outcome is possible, if not better.
Everything from schools, community centers,
absolutely,
as you say, people that saw you, I mean, recognize something in you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just in general, there was an ethic of care and an ethic of love that was sort of instilled in me in every place that I went, from my neighborhood to schools that I've been to. And I think I'm incredibly unfortunate in that way. And if this were the case for other people, I think the outcomes could be the same.
Let me read a tweet from Reek. Can't explain how proud I am of him and his mother. Their story means a lot to the community I come from.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel, not like the burden, but a bit of a responsibility that people are banking on you? I mean, clearly you've got success ahead of you.
No, I don't feel a burden. But I think what's interesting about that tweet is that it captures what's most important to me in terms of getting the story out there. And that's the idea that in our everyday lives, in terms of the conditions that we've been forced to live under, there's so many forces that are compelling us to foreclose on possibilities. But this story represents a sort of countervailing force that shows that our opportunities are possible, and it allows people to imagine different outcomes than the ones that they maybe think possible as a result of their immediate circumstances.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you back on Radio Times and to know what's ahead for you, Hazeem Hardiman. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me.
You're very welcome. Hazeem Hardiman, he is the first Rhodes Scholar to attend Community College of Philadelphia and Temple University. He'll be studying next year at Oxford University in England. Another short break, and then we'll be talking about whataboutism. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right?
Putin's a killer. A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
And if you look at, as an example, President Clinton pardoned Mark Rich. President Obama commuted the sentence of Chelsea Manning.
Well, I feel badly for General Flynn. I feel very badly. He's led a very strong life, and I feel very badly, John. I will say this. Hillary Clinton lied many times to the FBI. Nothing happened to her. Flynn lied, and they destroyed his life. I think it's a shame.
That, of course, is President Trump engaging in what is called whataboutism. It's a rhetorical tactic used to divert attention from a tough question and hopefully derail the questioner. It's used by politicians and pundits and a lot of us, and has its roots in the Soviet Union. We asked Tom Nichols to join us. He's a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, a Sovietologist, and a senior contributor at The Federalist. His newest book is called The Death of Expertise. Tom Nichols, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So where did the term whataboutism come from?
Well, it's actually rooted in the Cold War, that when Americans would criticize practices in the Soviet Union, the Soviet interlocutors, who were usually pretty good at this and had some training in how to handle talking to Westerners, would deploy the phrase of "what about," or that they would throw some terrible thing that happens in the United States as a way of drawing a moral equivalence. The classic phrase that they would use in the 60s and 70s was it literally translated to "But in America, you lynch Negroes."
Oh, goodness.
And that was always the answer to, you'd say, the Soviet Union is repressive, you don't have voting, people can't leave, you're poor, and they'd say yes. And then they would bring up lynchings and race relations and other problems. So it's an old tactic, and it has a long and storied history in the Cold War.
Well, is there a grain or a kernel of truth in when someone uses the tactic of whataboutism?
Sure. I mean, whataboutism, you know, the reason it's so popular is because it works, because, you know, we live in a fallen world. None of us are perfect. Any of us criticizing each other, I mean, it's, you know, there's even in the New Testament when Jesus himself says, you know, take the log out of your own eye before you take the speck out of your brother's. It's popular and it's easy because it deflects onto some other problem that may be real, while nonetheless squashing the larger issue. You know, with the in the case of the Cold War, you can always find things that go wrong in a democracy. But Soviet propagandists used to use that as a way of kind of hand waving, you know, kind of doing the Jedi mind trick to say, forget about the fact that the Soviet Union is a hideous dictatorship full of prison camps. You know, you have race problems in the United States. So the problem isn't that there isn't a grain of truth. It's that usually the comparison is so out of whack in terms of scale that it derails the conversation, which is what it's designed to do.
Right. And one can hear that. But does it also is sort of embedded in this, which is to say to the questioner, essentially, you are a hypocrite for asking me this question because look at you or look at the country where you're from.
Right. And it's meant to put the questioner on the defensive immediately to turn the discussion around, you know, to say, you have no right to criticize me because you've done something wrong at some point in your life. And again, it doesn't take into account magnitude. It doesn't take into account frequency. You know, every human being makes mistakes, but if whataboutism ruled our morality every day.
I think we just lost our guest. That was not the greatest phone line, so we will try to get him back on a better phone line. And again, we are talking about whataboutism, and we will be playing another clip of it as well. And as our guest Tom Nichols just said, it's basically a rhetorical tactic used to divert attention from a tough question. It has its roots in the Soviet Union, in the Cold War, as he said. And it's a way of creating, in a sense, a false moral equivalence, turning the question back on the critic or the questioner. And we'd love to hear from you about what you think about whataboutism. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is a phrase that has gotten some traction this year because we're hearing whataboutism from time to time coming from politicians and pundits. And I think it's probably a bipartisan thing, but it seems to have its roots in a authoritarian perspective or point of view. So we're hoping to hook up with Tom Nichols. I'm looking at my studio here and trying to read body language. And again, Tom Nichols is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College. He's also a Sovietologist, and he's a senior contributor at The Federalist, and wrote a book called The Death of Expertise. And I do believe that we have Tom Nichols back with us on Radio Times. Do we have you, Tom?
Yes, apparently the Russians didn't like us talking about what about us.
I know that's the kind of mood that a lot of people are in these days. Why do you think, just picking up on, I was just vamping there for a minute or two while we got you hooked up again, but if we're talking about the Cold War and the Soviet Union, why do you think the Soviet Union, I mean, there are plenty of other authoritarian countries and governments and dictatorships, why do you think the Soviets perfected this, if I can put it like that?
Well, first, we were their main rival in the world, but also the Soviets understood something essential about Western democracies, which is that we are very reflective and that we do think about our own flaws quite a lot. They knew that it would work, that for example, if we say, look, we don't like the way you treat Jews in the Soviet Union, they could turn around and say, well, what about the way you treat Indians? And, you know, we would kind of stop. And I think, you know, I had that one thrown at me when I was in the Soviet Union. And if you're a decent person, you sort of stop for a moment and say, I take your point. Although then you kind of say, well, and that was 150 years ago. And yes, reservations are bad, but there's still a bigger issue here, which is that you're a, you know, fenced in communist dictatorship. But they it worked because Westerners will stop and reflect and, you know, have a conscience. Whataboutism works best on an opponent who has an actual conscience, especially when deployed by someone who has none.
Well, that's interesting. Who do you think in current reality, who do you think is very good at this?
First, I should say I don't speak for the Navy in these comments. In our political environment, you know, the president and the Republicans have raised this to an art at this point. You began with a montage with, you know, the president, I think, you know, it's very effective. It gives people an out for, and look at the current Alabama Senate campaign, it gives people an out for talking about, comparing candidates to say, well, one may be accused of this, but what about your guy who supports, you know, abortion rights? Because an entirely different campaign, and it's always a way of kind of moving the issue off of character. Now, with that said, as a conservative myself back in the day, I used to find infuriating to have similar conversations with liberals who would deploy the same way. I mean, it's indent.
We seem to have lost our guest again. I do apologize to our listeners. Sometimes these phone lines just don't turn out the way that we hope them. So we will quickly get him back with us on Radio Times. And again, talking about this thing called whataboutism or whataboutisms. And we played a clip of the president, and I'm going to be playing a clip of Kellyanne Conway talking with George Stephanopoulos. We have an email from Emily. She said, I would love to know if your guest has any suggestions for journalists on how to respond and pivot back to whataboutisms are used during interviews, especially with politicians. What can the media do to push back against this tactic? And that's, of course, a question that needs an important answer. And hopefully when we get Tom Nichols back, we can answer that for you. Tom, I'm not sure what the problem is, but we've got you back. And let me fingers crossed, looking at the clock here, hopefully we'll make it up to 11 o'clock. But let me play a clip between Kellyanne Conway. She was on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos. This goes back to August. In fact, it's August 6th. And talking about the revelation that President Trump helped to dictate his son Don Jr.'s response regarding his meeting with a Russian lawyer who had promised opposition research on Hillary Clinton. This is still an issue that has some legs today. But this is the back and forth, and let's play it, and then we'll talk about it.
But first, the White House and the president's lawyers said he wasn't involved at all. They didn't tell the truth.
George, you know, I know there's this whole thing about where everybody wants to take
about
this tack.
Telling the truth.
You know, let's talk about telling the truth. Let's talk about a president looking Americans in the eye who are still suffering 8 years later, who were lied to. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. Benghazi happened because of a video. Go tell the families of those four innocent
Kellyanne,
Americans.
You're simply
who
changing
were
the subject
Benghazi,
right here.
That lie matters.
Hold on a second.
No, that
you're
is
a
subject.
The subject.
Let's talk about
back
credibility
to
that
President
impacts
Obama
people.
And Hillary Clinton.
And on and on. It went from there. And I have to say, Kellyanne Conway is very good in doing whataboutism. Do you agree, Tom?
Yeah, she's amazing at it. And I mean that, I don't mean that as a compliment, but she's very effective at it. And also at running out the clock, I think you see with a lot of the president's surrogates, you see them very effectively basically sucking the oxygen out of whatever's left of the segment at any given time by pushing the questioner onto highly defensive ground. Always lost in whataboutism is the original charge true?
Right.
You'll notice that never gets answered. Say, look, did you lie about this? Say, well, you know, other people lie. Okay, fine, stipulated. But did you lie? Well, you know, I knew a guy who lied once, and you never get an answer.
We had someone who sent us an email question saying, and this is what we just heard is a good example. So under those circumstances, when someone that you're interviewing is using whataboutism, what should the interviewer do?
I think you should refuse to engage and say, well, you know what? That's a conversation for another day. I'm just asking you if the thing I just asked you is true.
I mean, just don't get derailed by...
Don't get derailed. I mean, you really, I think, with anyone, and, you know, again, I actually bring to this years of arguing with, you know, Soviet even Soviet friends and colleagues back in the day, you simply cannot allow yourself to be derailed and say, okay, if you want to have a separate conversation about how, you know, the United States treated Indian tribes in 1850, we'll have that discussion. But first, we're going to finish this one.
Is it a form of propaganda? Do you see it that way?
Without doubt. I mean, it's something you really, at least in the old Soviet system, it's something you had to be trained to do. It comes naturally to people as a way of deflection, but to use it effectively, like the Soviets used to, or like a trained public relations expert, like Kellyanne Conway does, you really are engaging in a tactic that you have to work at. It's not accidental.
Are we hearing more whataboutism in the United States these days?
I think so, because I think that the things that we used to share among ourselves, that character matters, that there are certain things that are, you know, beyond the pale of politics, these are all things we used to agree on where we could disagree about politics. Those lines have been crossed in every direction, and that leads to a lot of whataboutism, because you're constantly trying to get the moral stain off of yourself and onto the other guy. You're not, it's the kind of thing that happens when you're not arguing about marginal tax rates, and instead you're arguing about, you know, whether it's okay to pick up teenagers at the mall. So I think, yeah, it's become a lot more widespread, and you're going to see it happening a lot more often.
Here's a tweet. Shirley, what about her emails? This is a good example of current whataboutism. And of course, the president and others raise that a lot when questions about the FBI investigation come up.
This is one place where I think that Hillary Clinton supporters play into that, and in a way that does not help themselves, with memes that I see, for example, on Twitter all the time, saying, but her emails. Well, you know, the fact that the Trump administration has done a lot of bad things does not then retroactively excuse the Clinton administration, or the Clinton campaign, rather, for what Hillary Clinton did with her emails. And both sides, again, are trying to, you know, leverage this for their advantage, that when Trump does something awful, Clintonites say, you know, what about but her emails? Or when the Trump people are pinned down, they say, but Hillary Clinton's emails. Again, you asked what to do about it. I'd say, if you want to have a separate conversation about Hillary Clinton's emails, let's have that conversation. But that doesn't affect the truth or falsity of the issue we're talking about at the moment.
We're almost out of time here. I also see here you are a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion.
I am.
How did that happen? That's so great. How did that happen?
But mostly by accident. I played back in the days when they retired you after 5 games. And I kind of at the last minute threw in a postcard to become a contestant. I'd watched since I was a little boy. And the next thing I knew, I was winning. I actually lost my 5th game, but I was correct about a question that they ruled me wrong on, so I got to come back. So I had to play 6 games to win 5, but it was a really great experience. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. Well, Tom, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Tom. Sorry about the technical problems.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. That's Tom Nichols, professor at the U.S. Naval War College, a Sovietologist, a senior contributor at The Federalist, wrote a book called The Death of Expertise, and a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bill, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.